My parents are not only letting me stay up late in my feety pajamas, but they also let me use the Ron Mallett time machine to go back to February 1964 so I can watch the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. The disruption of the space-time vortex caused the deaths of 7 future Nobel Peace Prize winners, but it was so worth it. Okay, time to watch history being made. Huh, there's something a little wrong with the color on this TV set.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them, right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Oh, no. Something else has been damaged by my time travel. The Beatles are not cute boys anymore. They're disgusting insects climbing around on a huge ball of dung. I don't believe in God, but please, Stephen Hawking and Neil deGrasse Tyson and Richard Dawkins, undo everything I've done and change history back to what it used to be. Nothing, huh? Well, today on the show, we're taking all of you back to 1964, when pop music changed forever. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the gassy Beatle, Colin McEnroe.
Thank you so much. Yes, we are. We're going to take you back to 1964. We're going to talk to you about a time when, really, everything seemed to change in the world of music. We've got a lot of great guests for you, but the one that I'm incredibly honored to be presenting right now, to get us started, one of the guys who was playing that music for Americans in 1964, and certainly if you grew up in Connecticut, I don't need to tell you anything about him, at least if you grew up in Connecticut then. His name is Dick Robinson. He spent an incredible career in broadcasting. If I were to try to describe it, the show would be over, but including a popular stint as a host on WDRC. He's also the founder and president of the Society for the Preservation of the Great American Songbook. Dick Robinson, as a boyhood fan of yours, I'm so excited to have you on the show today. It's almost like having a Beatle.
I'm an elderly fan of yours, Colin.
So first of all, you know, in 1964, there was something going on called the British Invasion that involved a lot of bands. But was it evident to you and to everybody else in radio that the Beatles and Beatlemania was almost a separate thing with its own magnitude that exceeded everything else that was happening?
Well, we saw, you know, before that, Colin, we saw Sinatra, and then we saw Elvis, but this was, I was just coming to Hartford, and we were there at the airport in New York, and it was something I've never seen before. The amount of hysteria, the amount of people, it was just, and the boys themselves, John Paul, George, and Ringo, they were hip, they were funny, and they were on fire. It was just a time that I can never, ever, ever forget. Chaos, the noise level, it was just, you couldn't even hear yourself think, Colin.
You know, my recollection, reading recollections from you and other people, broadcasters of that era, include the idea, and this might be hard for younger people to grasp right now, but getting the actual record to play, you know, any individual 45 Beatles record that you were going to play, it didn't happen automatically. You couldn't, ship an MP3 file on the internet. So you guys were like meeting airplanes that had the records on them, right?
Exactly what we're doing. We didn't even have cell phones back in those days. Al Gore didn't invent the internet yet. And what happened was we'd get a record that came in, a real record, not a CD or a, this is a 45, a little flat, a 45, and the calls are coming in here too. And what would happen is we'd have the guys stop along the turnpike coming up and make a call from a phone booth and say, hey, we got the record. We got the new record by the Beatles. It'll be there at the studios in 2 hours. And then they'd call an hour later from New Haven, say, we're going to bring it up. And it would be, everybody would be on the edge of their seat or the edge of their bed or whatever, waiting for the new Beatles record. But they were, even before they came, Colin, there was such excitement about them, because we had talked about them, played them before they arrived, and when they got there, Everybody knew them. Everybody was, the excitement factor was just something I've never seen before.
And Dick Robinson, do you remember whether you had a shift the day after that first Ed Sullivan performance? So that's Sunday night, February 9th. Did you go on the air the next day? And was there an even different crackle of excitement as a result of that?
Oh, yeah, there was. There was, that night with Ed Sullivan, who was, that was a great program back in those days. And he was just blown away by what had happened. He had never seen anything like it. I mean, every time you mention any word, if you mention the word John, you mention the word, any word you mention, the kids would scream. And just, it was just a wonderful, wonderful, chaotic, but beautiful, beautiful time.
Well, Dick Robinson, just hearing your voice brings it back to me, and thank you so much for kicking things off for us here. It is, it really is truly an honor to have you. You're a broadcasting legend, and maybe we can set something else again in the future.
Well, anytime, Colin. We love you, and just stay doing what you're doing. We all love radio. I've been in it almost 60 years now, and it's a pleasure to be there, and it was a pleasure to be around with the Beatles, and it's a pleasure to wake up. Today we have a new radio station in Palm Beach. We're signing on today, and I've been up for 40 hours so far. And we've got legendsradio.com anywhere in the world, but down here we've got a new FM. And I'm blessed to have met the Beatles, blessed to have heard you, and just blessed to get up every day and have fun.
All right, Dick Robinson, thanks for joining us. I want to eat whatever he's eating because he is immortal and tireless. All right, our chief senior musicologist, Steve Metcalf, is with us. He's going to be guiding us through these waters today. Thanks again to Dick Robinson. Steve Metcalf grew up in Schenectady, so maybe Dick Robinson, not quite the set of memories that he is for me. But so, Steve Metcalf, I guess maybe I'm going to begin, before you even say a word, with just to remind people kind of the sound a little bit. We've got a bunch of Beatles songs here, but let's start with Please Please Me. I mean, that's as good an example of what was going on then as anything else. I'd love to play the whole thing, but then, as I say, we'll use up too much time. So, Steve Metcalf.
Pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does sound pretty good. So talk a little bit about that. How revolutionary was this sound in 64?
Well, first of all, as I think all good Beatle fans know, the history is a little convoluted here, because the way things unfolded in England were a little different from the way they unfolded in the United States. So Please Please Me, in early 1963, became the first real monster hit that the Beatles released. They had made the charts with Love Me Do a few months earlier, but it was Please Please Me that sort of vaulted them to sudden, national stardom in their own country, to the eternal shame and embarrassment of Capitol Records. The executives at Capitol declined to release Please Please Me. They didn't think it had sufficient hit status, and so it was given off to this tiny little label and didn't actually do much in the United States, whereas, in England it is basically the tune that vaulted the Beatles to stardom, as I say. One thing that I didn't realize, even in my sort of Beatle mania, is that John Lennon, who wrote Please Please Me in its entirety, originally intended it as sort of a slow, keening ballad a la Roy Orbison, one of his heroes. And it was actually George Martin who listened to that and wasn't particularly impressed by it, Martin, of course, being their producer, who suggested that they turn it into an up-tempo song, which they immediately did, and the rest, as they say, is history.
You know, Steve, on the one hand, you have this group that is maybe more than other rock and roll groups keenly aware of a whole bunch of musical traditions that preceded it. On the other hand, as we're learning more and more, and this Mark Lewisohn, the first volume of this epic three-volume Beatles biography that's supposed to end in 2028, as it tells us. But maybe you can say a little bit about this. In terms of really knowing how to write a song or even being trained musicians, they weren't that, right?
They were far from that. In fact, the book kind of shockingly makes it clear just how little any of them knew about the nuts and bolts of music. I mean, McCartney's dad had a kind of career in music, and so McCartney was more familiar with, like, old standards than the other three. But really, all of them basically only knew American rock and roll, and even only that portion of American rock and roll that made its way to England. And in terms of the mechanics of music, you know, harmony or chords or theory or anything, they really just knew absolutely nothing. There's this kind of poignant little anecdote in Lewisohn's book that talks about George Harrison, who was then, you know, just a 16 or 17 year old, walking blocks and blocks to some kid's house because the kid somehow knew a B flat 7 chord, and George wanted to figure out how to play that chord on his guitar. And you know, I mean, that's how rudimentary their grasp of music was.
You know, in some ways, that makes it maybe less surprising that they broke a lot of rules. And early on, even though they became famous as experimenters and pioneers later on, even early on, they're doing some different things. One thing that they did that's been pointed out by a number of writers is on certain songs, She Loves You and a song we're about to play right now, they'd begin with a chorus. Which is rather uncommon. And actually, one of the other songs they do that is It Won't Be Long. Let's play, we won't play them beginning with the chorus, but here's a little bit of the, you know, less of a big, huge hit, It Won't Be Long.
It won't be long, yeah.
All right, it won't be long. Now, Steve Metcalf, you hear certain things in that song, although maybe some of the things you hear come up a little bit later.
Well, no, but I mean, not to sound geeky here, but it's true that, I mean, that's a very early song, and yet, you know, not only does it begin on the chorus, but it begins on a six chord, which is a pretty unusual little device, and it's not just a, as they say in music, an ABA song. It has this little interesting C section, not to be confused with other C sections, but you know, where there's also some counterpoint in the vocal line and kind of two things going on at once, and again, not to get too nerdy about it, but it's, you know, it already, I think, contains the seeds of a sort of a, you know, an original mind and a sort of a curiosity about expanding popular music that obviously we saw the fruits of in the next few years.
We should say, we're talking to Steve Metcalf right now. I call him our chief musicologist. He has many other things. He's the Ed Sullivan of the Garmany Chamber Music Series at the Hart School at the University of Hartford. On Thursday night, Sybaride 5, the Beatles of modern chamber music, will play at Hart. Actually, their program does include some radical repurposings of Radiohead and sometimes even Led Zeppelin. So I
like Ed Sullivan of the of the Garmany series. In fact, I believe I'm going to have some new business cards made up.
All right. We also talked this week to one of Steve Metcalf's friends and colleagues, John Platoff, a professor of music at Trinity College in Hartford. We've got two chunks of that interview. Let's hear the first chunk now. We're talking to John Platoff. He's a professor of music at Trinity College, one of the many academics who follows the Beatles, who writes about the Beatles and thinks about the Beatles. They are unique in that way, I think, as in many others. We did a whole show about this a while ago, the degree to which or the frequency with which the Beatles are just taught on college campuses everywhere. John Platoff, just to start off, and I know that one of the things that you're going to be saying today is that if everything kind of stayed musically where it was in 1964, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. The fact that the Beatles mutated and morphed and deepened, and you know, that's one of the reasons that 50 years after their arrival on the Ed Sullivan Show, we're still talking about them. But can we just focus on 64 for a second? In your mind, how much of a musical revolution was it that they were making these particular sounds at that particular moment?
I think it was less a musical revolution at that moment than a cultural revolution. Mm-hmm. I think that as opposed to the legacy of what made the Beatles great, which is their extraordinary music making, mm-hmm. the impact they had then was, wow, they're from Britain, mm-hmm. and they have this extraordinarily long hair. I mean, it's laughable now, but those haircuts were seen as so radical. And yet they're British. They speak in these wonderful accents. They're dressed up in neat, clean suits. They're funny. They joke around. And they're playing what's basically black American rock and roll with an English accent. They were new and shocking and a novelty at that time.
Actually, let's just remind you a little bit. You'll be hearing Beatles music all the way through the show today, but let's hear a little bit of I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. And I say that something. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand.
So, John Platoff, I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about the fact that, okay, it's 50 years later now. And so then think about what was 50 years later in 1964. If you looked back 50 years, you'd find Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern, who I suppose you could argue were also changing the face of popular music in a certain way. If you look 50 years back, you can see Stravinsky and Schoenberg, who were actually causing riots.
Sure.
I mean, they were changing music, not popular music so much. And rather than touching off a mania of adoration the way the Beatles were, they were just completely freaking people out in a way that made their music very difficult to even stage mm-hmm. because people were so freaked out by it. So this seems different somehow. 50 years after this, this music still sounds exciting. And I think that is kind of a testament to the geniuses we were meeting on those days.
Yeah, there were two geniuses in that group. Paul McCartney and John Lennon, I genuinely think, were musical and poetic geniuses. And beyond that, they had two other really talented musicians in George Harrison and Ringo Starr. They were really experienced performers, which is something people tend to forget, that by the time they were a sudden success in England and then in the United States, they'd played hundreds and hundreds of shows in Liverpool and in Hamburg, where they worked for three successive years. And so they grew up playing rock and roll, and by the time they started writing their own songs, they knew everything that there was to know about the rock and roll of the early 60s.
I think they not only knew that, but they knew a lot about popular music in general. And I think, you know, McCartney in particular so much grew up with the kind of music hall tradition. So around 1964, on a parallel track, the Kinks were doing All Day and All the Night, mm-hmm. you know, and You Really Got Me. And these were songs that in some ways overthrew conventional thinking about songwriting in a way that the Beatles did not. I mean, I Want to Hold Your Hand starts out with one interesting musical idea, goes to a chorus with interesting musical idea, and then shifts into this lovely bridge. It's a sophisticated adult piece of songwriting which doesn't really turn its back on conventional pop music writing of the Great American Songbook / Noel Coward era.
Right. Well, they brought a lot of things in. They knew rock and roll, but they also knew Carl Perkins and the country tradition, the bluegrass tradition a little bit. You hear the Everly Brothers in songs like Please Please Me. Mm. The rock and rollers of their era won better because they were such good singers in harmony. Mm-hmm. And you notice that in I Want to Hold Your Hand, in She Loves You, very much in Please Please Me. With the two lines very right at the beginning where one person is holding the note and the other one is singing down, making constantly changing harmonies against it.
Do you think also they were making harmonic choices that were a little bit interesting, at least in terms of what one might have heard on the radio from 1960 to 1964? I mean, another thing that's going on right then is Brian Wilson is doing I Get Around, which is harmonically interesting in a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, he's really trying to almost use some of the qualities of a barbershop quartet or an a cappella group or something like that. But what they're doing, I mean, I want to hold your hand. Even that chorus resolves in a chord that's a little bit different from what you might hear in conventional harmonies. Yeah.
They found inventive, surprising things to do. I Saw Her Standing There, one of the big hits and one of the first song on their opening album. It's mostly 1-4-5-1, the standard kind of blues rock and roll chords, but all of a sudden there's a flat six in there. Mm-hmm. And they have, of course, had no idea it was a flat six. They found that sound by fooling around on the guitar and liked it. They were very, very inventive at every stage.
Yeah, it seems as though one of the things that persists from this moment through the whole Beatles story as we talk about it is a failure to be satisfied with the first answer that they got, right? You know, there probably was an earlier iteration of almost all of these songs that would have been okay and probably would have done pretty well for them. You sense that they pushed it a little bit.
Right. They were not easily satisfied. It's true. For all that they laughed and clowned around and were charming and, you know, had snappy comebacks with the press in those days, whenever they were fortunate enough to be asked a question about the music as opposed to a silly question about their hair or something, they took it very seriously. They took themselves seriously as musicians and were always looking to grow and develop things. One of the things I do when I teach a Beatles song in a class is show the subtle things that happen when the verse comes back or the chorus comes back the second time. They don't sing it the same way. They add a harmony or they put in finger cymbals on the weak beats. They find something to add in, and they're really composing in a very ambitious way.
I guess the other thing that's that strikes me, too, is even now, so 50 years later, you'd think that every possible master and every piece of tape that they ever recorded has already been pawed over, but apparently not. I mean, and there is among people like you, I think, but also just among fans, a real interest. What else is there that can show us something about this process?
Right. There is that, and there is also the fact that, as Neil Aspinall, their roadie and later manager of Apple, said, one thing I've noticed about people with a lot of money is they're never unhappy about having even more.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a commercial aspect to, there are all these tapes still in the vault that haven't been released. What can we plausibly put out there that adds something to the Beatles' legacy without merely being about the money?
Just to stay with 64 for a second here, too. I mean, one of the things, there's sort of two ways to look at this moment, I think. One of them is, all right, this is kind of a revolutionary sound in all of the ways that you've just talked about. And I subscribe to that utterly. Another way to look at it that I think I could also subscribe to is there's actually sort of a lot going on in popular music. I mean, we've just mentioned a few of them. I mean, the Beach Boys, you know, Brian hasn't really rotated over into what he's going to do that's really going to shock people and startle even the Beatles. Mm-hmm. But he's getting close. You've got the Kinks and people like that and other Merseybeat kinds of groups. But you've also got, I mean, one of the big hits that year was Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison, which is a gorgeous song in ways that the Beatles utterly would have approved of, you know, does some interesting things.
Oh, they were crazy about Roy Orbison. They were thrilled once when they got to go on tour with him, absolutely.
And Bacharach is just getting out of the work that he was doing. It was a little bit more straight work for the Drifters, kind of brill building kind of work. Mm-hmm. You know, that year, Anyone Who Had a Heart comes out, which is, I think, one of the moments where Bacharach begins to rotate a little bit more into more sophisticated and surprising songwriting, taking a few more chances. So another thing that's going on is it's just really an exciting time in pop music.
It is, and it comes at the end of a rather dry spell. Mm-hmm. The last couple of years of the 50s and the first couple of years of the 60s were a lot less interesting than, say, the mid-50s, when you had Rock Around the Clock and you had Elvis making the great early Elvis hits. And one of the things that make the Beatles look so good when they first hit America is songs like Dominique, you know, not really a high point in the history of American pop music. There was a lot of junky, ordinary stuff being played. A song called Sugar Shack, you might remember, makes most of us wince when we think about it.
Speak for yourself.
Okay. Well, to each his own, said the old lady as she kissed the cow. But there was a lot out there in commercial pop that was kind of schlocky. Mm-hmm. And what people forget is, because there's a lot of talk about the Beatles being hyped before they got to this country. But what people forget is I Want to Hold Your Hand became a hit because somebody, some flight attendant, brought a 45 of it home from England And somehow somebody played it on a radio station somewhere, and people started calling in and saying, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
And finally Capitol Records got behind it and said, okay, let's release this in the United States. So there was a genuine groundswell that came from the interest in the music first, not from the mop-top haircuts or anything else.
That's John Platoff of Trinity, recorded on Monday. We'll have a little bit more from him in the next segment, too, but Steve Metcalf also with us. Steve, this is a point. The point that he's making at the end here is a point that you've made, too, which was that there was a lot of fairly unexciting stuff on the pop charts leading up to this incredible starburst by the Beatles.
Well, yeah, I mean, both things are true simultaneously, I think, Colin. You know, I mean, you're right. You know, Brian Wilson is starting to find his voice, although I Get Around didn't come to until a few months later. You know, Pretty Woman is a great tune, and certainly Bach Rock, you know, is finding his way. But, you know, in all fairness, if you look at 1962 and 63, it is, shall we say, a confused time for American popular music. A lot of people, older elders, were saying, well, you know, so this kind of proves that rock and roll was indeed just an aberration, just like we said. I mean, even poor old Elvis is reduced to tunes like, you know, Bossa Nova Baby. And the charts also revealed items like the theme from Dr. Kildare by the distinguished vocalist Richard Chamberlain. So I mean, it's just a time where I think American popular music was kind of drifting and kind of lost, and it was really fertile soil, I think. I mean, people talk a lot about the fact that the Kennedy assassination had left everybody sort of in a mood to be kind of cheered up, and I'm sure that's true. But I do think musically there was just there was an opening for them, and needless to say, they found that opening.
All right, let's grab a quick break here. We're going to come back with Steve Metcalf after this, give you a little bit more of John Platoff. Later in the show, musician Rex Fowler, who went on to start Aztec Two Step, will talk about what it was like to wake up to that music.
Do you remember when the Beatles first came to the U.S.?
Yeah, of course. Ed Sullivan Show. Never seen anything like them. And, of course, my parents said, boy, look how long their hair is.
I remember that my friend Allison went to the Shea Stadium concert, second only to maybe having gone to Woodstock.
I mean, I was listening to the Kingston Trio then. I mean, come on, I was a square.
All right. Voices from the Street, talking about memories of the Beatles. Steve Metcalf is with us. He is a music critic, composer, pianist. He's talking in the background. Music critic, a composer, pianist, and the Ed Sullivan of the Garmany Chamber Music Series at Hart School, which continues at the University of Hartford on Thursday night with Sybarite 5. Get your ticket now. So Steve Metcalf, one of the other things that's happening here 50 years ago is the introduction of a group that, despite the fact that they are doing a little bit of Meredith Wilson and they're doing Besame Mucho and they're doing Taste of Honey, the thing that they're doing that's startling is that they are writing their own music. And in fact, how unusual was that at that moment?
Well, in the rock and roll world, it was almost completely unheard of. I mean, we did have the example of Buddy Holly, you know, who wrote some great tunes, obviously, in his very brief, sadly brief career. And in the sort of earlier period of standards, there was the occasional singer-songwriter like Hoagy Carmichael, who of course wrote Stardust and a bunch of other great songs, and a little bit later Johnny Mercer was both a performer and a songwriter. But in the rock world, you know, this was really just unprecedented. And in fact, as I think everybody knows, when George Martin, you know, first somewhat reluctantly agreed to take the Beatles on at the Parlophone record label, you know, he assumed and indeed urged on the lads any number of songs written by so-called professional songwriters, you know, including songs that actually did go on to be hits for the likes of Jerry and the Pacemakers and other people. But, you know, nobody really even gave any thought to the idea that performers could also be creators in that way, and it was only after Martin, you know, kind of skeptically challenged them to make good on this that that he had to concede after they came up with something like 14 consecutive number one hits that, you know, perhaps they were onto something after all.
You know, We're talking to Steve Metcalf right now. This was, as the distinguished musicologist Bill Curry pointed out to me earlier today, this was sort of a demographically perfectly timed thing in the sense that if you start the baby boom clock running in 1947, it's leading its oldest edge in 1964 was, to quote from a song, just 17. So, you know, you have sort of this huge bulge that is perfectly poised to enjoy and get excited about this absolutely unique youth phenomenon. But we remember it as a youth phenomenon. But one question I have for you is, I mean, obviously all kinds of scholars like John Platoff and everybody takes it very seriously now. How long did it take for adult culture to take the Beatles seriously?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I try to think back myself because, I mean, I was, what, 15 or something when they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I think we were all, those of us who became instantly sort of captivated by these guys, were also, for whatever reason, hoping that the adult culture would also recognize them as being special. And to my recollection, the breakthrough moment was when the very acerbic film critic Pauline Kael did a compilation of the top 10 movies from, what, I guess it must have been 65, and put Hard Day's Night in it. And I remember it actually got a lot of attention sort of in the press because Pauline Kael basically didn't like anything, and the idea that she accorded the Beatles, you know, a place on her honored top 10 list, I think really did get everybody's attention. And as I think I mentioned a little time later, when Rubber Soul came out, the music magazine Stereo Review gave it a very laudatory review. And again, this was a publication that mostly wrote about classical music and you know, none too generously much of the time. And so, you know, little by little, you had this sense that even grown-ups, as it were, and even kind of hard-to-please grown-ups were suddenly coming to understand that this was something other than just, you know, the mop tops.
All right, let's hear the second half of our interview with Trinity music professor John Platoff. One of the things I've struggled with to remember, unsuccessfully, I was born in 1954, so I was 10 years old, roughly, when all this was happening. And so I don't really remember my parents' reaction, although my parents would have been the kind of people who would have been fanatically incurious about the Beatles. But I think for people of their generation, we're going to play a little bit of a song called, maybe a little less well-known, a song called Ask Me Why.
If I cry, it's not because I'm sad. Can't believe it's happened to me. I can't conceive of any more misery. Ask me why. I'll say I love you, and I'm always thinking of you.
Talking with John Platoff, he's a professor of music at Trinity College. You know, you listen to a song like that, and once again, there's enough of a nod to a couple of familiar songwriting styles, enough of a nod to genre, that this, although it was the music of youth and there were girls screaming their heads off and stuff like that, my guess is that adults of the day wouldn't have felt as comfortable rejecting it as they would, say, the Kinks singing, you know, All Day and All the Night.
Right, or the Rolling Stones early hits that were really, really hardcore blues. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's true. You mentioned that Paul McCartney's background via his father was sort of a dance hall. Mm-hmm. They used to sing in the days before they were writing their own music, when they were still doing a lot of live shows and were not well known and were covering other people's songs. They would sing Besame Mucho and they would sing Latin hits. Paul used to sing that the famous ballad from The Music Man.
There were bells on the hill.
Exactly, which is a far cry from what you would expect out of a rock and roll
band.
Of
course, so did Marvin and Tammy, ultimately.
Speaking of immortals.
Yeah, yeah, they did the same song. But yeah, Meredith Wilson, maybe not a big part of the rock and roll canon otherwise. If they just stayed there, that would have been interesting. But the steady progression over this incredibly short period of time. In fact, let's vault way ahead. So think about everything that you've just heard. And then really in the space of just a few years, well, let's play Tomorrow Never Knows.
Turn off your mind, relax
So John Platoff, that's about as far from Ask Me Why as one could get, except that it didn't take them very many years to make that leap.
They were very inventive. They had a producer named George Martin who was willing to give them their heads in the studio. Mm-hmm. And by 1966, when they made Tomorrow Never Knows, they were freely experimenting with sound and technology. They were also doing a lot of LSD, which you can very much hear in the whole attitude of that song and a lot of the music on Revolver. But a lot of other people were doing LSD and not making music like that. So it wasn't simply a matter of the drugs. It was a matter of, again, experimentation, talent. They had a studio at their disposal. One of the things you hear later on in Tomorrow Never Knows is that Lennon's voice changes dramatically. He told George Martin he wanted his voice to sound like a bunch of Tibetan monks chanting on top of a mountain. And George Martin said, John, I'm frankly not sure we can achieve that. But what they did is they took the rotating Leslie speaker out of an electronic organ and ran his voice through that. So it has a very distant, kind of monumental, removed sound that was extraordinary for 1966. And that's just typical of the kind of thing they were doing.
Yeah, and I think this came up the last time we did a show about the Beatles, but it's worth repeating. I think what's remarkable at this point is that they now are, in addition to being the most popular musicians in the world, avant-garde musicians who are in touch with other actual, solely avant-garde musicians and are aware of the work of avant-garde musicians. So to go back to 1914, it would be as if Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern and the person who wrote Abba Dabba Honeymoon, which was a big hit that year, were working intimately with and were basically incorporating into their work everything Schoenberg was doing at the Skandal concert and what Stravinsky was doing in Rite of Spring, right? This is all just in one great big package come 1966.
That's a great point. And McCartney in particular in 1966 was listening to Stockhausen and going to avant-garde concerts. And so the idea of tape loops in Tomorrow Never Knows, where you hear those seagull sounds, that's a reversed tape loop of one of the Beatles laughing. And there are many other reversed sounds. They play backwards guitar licks. They try every possible experiment, including at the very end of Tomorrow Never Knows, you hear Lennon singing backwards.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Let's hear a little bit of another song from that period, a little more conventional song. But in its own way, a bit of a surprise. Let's hear Eleanor Rigby.
Why does he care for all the lonely people? Where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong?
Talking to John Platoff from Trinity College, where he is a professor of music. And once again, I'm sort of straining a little bit in my own brain to remember what that sounded like in 1966. You know, it wasn't as though no popular artist had ever used strings, but nobody had ever really used strings quite that way, I don't think.
And nobody had ever, in popular music, addressed death, loneliness, and alienation in such an unblinking way. That song, not to exaggerate, is sort of like T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. It's so bleak. And if you compare it to Leader of the Pack, which is a story also about an unfortunate death, but it's so conventional and teenage girl emotional by comparison. Eleanor Rigby is really a shock when you hear it on a rock and roll album in 1966.
Interestingly to me, if you listen to their music from the very beginning, in some ways they're always maybe a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of the themes that they're looking at. I'm not suggesting that She Loves You, Yeah, 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 is you know, the equivalent of Revolution or Strawberry Fields or something like that. But it's a little bit different than, you know, it really wasn't a conventional love song. It was about telling somebody else, that somebody else loves him.
Right.
You know, and it's, first of all, a very recognizable thing. You know, I mean, anybody who's ever been in middle school or high school has had that conversation. You know, she loves you. You know, isn't that great? Isn't that great news? But, I mean, you know, lyrically, that was kind of interesting. But that was nothing compared to what they were prepared to undertake. And certainly, by the time they get to Revolver, they're starting to really experiment with what music can be about.
In so many different directions. A song like Yesterday gets overlooked because it's such a classic, if not a cliche. It's apparently it's the most covered, most recorded song in the history of popular music. There were 2,000 covers of it 10 or 15 years ago. I have no idea what the number is now. But even there, you've got McCartney strumming an acoustic guitar with a halo of strings around him. And what's that doing as a rock and roll song in 1965?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to Strawberry Fields and you've got a symphony orchestra. You've got brasses. You've got the amazing things in A Day in the Life, again, weaving together an orchestra and all sorts of sounds. You've got Indian sitar coming in as early as Norwegian Wood. They are, you know, thinking outside the box is a cliche, but it applies in this case. They were not limited at all by what typical rock and roll bands did.
And so, you know, you teach modern music, too. And it, we were talking before about we got Sub Ride 5 coming in here tomorrow. And they'll be covering. So here's a modern chamber group. And they're covering and repurposing Radiohead. This kind of thing went on and still goes on. But it does feel like what we're talking about right now is a moment where two lines crossed in a way that they just typically don't cross and haven't ever, the line of incredibly popular American music and the line of the most daring possibilities you can explore in music. I mean, one group was doing both of those things at once. And not to belabor that point, but I mean, has that ever happened? Will it ever happen again?
I think it's always possible, but what I hear of commercial pop today, I have teenage children, and so I, you know, tend to hear what they're listening to, doesn't very much strike me as sounding like it's being ambitious. I don't hear artists reaching to do something unexpected and pulling in something that's outside the norm. I hear the sound of commercial pop trying to build on what is currently popular by doing the logical next step and not something completely out of left field.
I mean, look, through the whole history of pop music, there have been these outliers, whether it's Frank Zappa or Captain Beefheart or something like that, but they're not that popular.
I mean, right.
That's the
a good
thing
point.
That makes this remarkable, yeah. Yeah. Is that these guys were doing this and they were really popular.
I think one element of that is that by about 1966, they were beyond popular. They were gods of popular music. Mm-hmm. They could do anything and sell it, and they believed they could do anything and sell it. And they were so successful and so wealthy by that time that they weren't worried about whether they could sell it. And so they really did follow their own instincts. As you know, after Revolver, they did one final American tour in the summer of 1966, and they said, that's it. We're going to be studio musicians now because the concerts are musically unsatisfying. The fans scream so loud we can't hear ourselves play. The music we're making now can't be performed live because we need studio effects. And so after that, they were a studio band, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, right through Abbey Road at the end. They decided we're going only to make music in the studio and please ourselves. And they didn't have to worry about their audience anymore. They had this enormous confidence that the audience would follow them, which largely it did.
John Platoff, so great to talk to you today. John Platoff, a professor of music at Trinity College. Let's go out with one of John's favorite songs, Sugar Shack. No, not really. We're not going to do that.
Please no.
There's a crazy little shack beyond the tracks. And everybody calls it the Sugar Shack.
Today's show was brought to you by
Anacin. The headache remedy with a special combination of ingredients to relieve pain, to relax tension, soothe irritability. Anacin. And by Pillsbury, makers of light, fluffy Pillsbury refrigerated biscuits and a complete line of fresh dough foods in the dairy case.
Aspirin biscuits. It's part of a balanced breakfast and something my body needs anyway. Our show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our fearless intern, Anna Novak of the North. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and Katie Talarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Pete Best. For show pages, extras, stories, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff in their Sergeant Pepper uniforms, visit our website, WNPR.org. Tomorrow, a show about secret societies. And now, back to Colin.
All right. I've got 40 minutes of content and about 4.5 minutes to do it in. I'm going to go to Rex Fowler in just a quick second. But Steve Metcalf, while we've got you here, you know, listening to the conversation with John Platoff, I mean, I'm even just struck by the fact that we talk about a period of the Beatles music that's 1964, you know, and then the period that's Hard Day's Night and Help and Yesterday and Today, and then Rubber Soul and Revolver. This is all over 3 years, right?
Right. I mean, it just shows the almost lightning tempo at which they were progressing because, you know, after all, those were sort of very different periods, and they really made progress at a rate, I think, honestly, without sounding crazy about it, was kind of unprecedented in the history of music.
I mean, I think when you say that, it means something, too. I mean, because you can look at Bach and Beethoven and all. I mean, in 3 years, I guess none of those guys changed styles as rapidly anyway.
Well, I mean, we speak of Beethoven's three periods, roughly, and so on, but each of them was a number of years and was kind of laboriously, you know, worked through, whereas, you know, the Beatles' progression was just lightning-like. I mean, we talked the other day about there was that period of 2.5 years or so where they basically created a song, by the way, that most of us continue to know 50 years later at the rate of one every, you know, 12 days or so.
Amazing. So, hey, I want to just leave a little bit of time here. I'm sorry for sort of screwing up the clock. I don't have enough time at all. But Rex Fowler's with us also, co-founder of Aztec Two-Step, and more recently, The Newtopians, a seven-piece ensemble that celebrates the music of John Lennon. So, Rex Fowler, first of all, were you a little kid watching, or a kid anyway, watching Ed Sullivan on that night 50 years ago?
I certainly was, 15 years old, sitting with Anna Parker and Roy Pettengill and Kathy Sweet, and I'll never forget it. And it was the main reason why I went to Ed Sullivan's wake in New York City was because of his, you know, the fact that he brought these amazing acts on. Of course, nothing topped the Beatles.
And I mean, talk about, I mean, you maybe you didn't know that you were going to be a full-time professional musician at the time, but was there something waking up inside you? I mean, I suppose it's easy to romanticize that looking back, but do you feel like hearing the Beatles did change things forever for you?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, it really took Bob Dylan for me to actually want to pick up a musical instrument. Seeing the Beatles, hearing Elvis, I'm old enough to remember all of the great, you know, starting with Sinatra and Company in the back seat of the 55 Buick or whatever. And then, you know, to hear Elvis come along and sing Heartbreak Hotel, which really startled me, even as a 9-year-old kid or whatever. But the Beatles, I mean, coming out of the devastation of Kennedy's assassination, it really did lift us up. It was almost like the yellow brick road. All of a sudden, boom, you know, on came, you know, the colored version of it. It was, you know, just extraordinary. And there's been so much talked about, your learned guest. I mean, it really is fascinating. One thing I want to point out is I'll Be Back, which first appeared in the United States on Beatles 65, but it was the last song in A Hard Day's Night, which was extremely downbeat, surprisingly downbeat farewell, you know, at the height of Beatlemania. So but what it was an indication of their coming maturity, you know, that really, and the inner journey that they took in as your guests have talked about, and this happened all in less than 2 years and three albums time, when it culminated with Rubber Soul, of course.
It's amazing. We're going to have to stop there. We want to thank everybody who helped out today, especially our chief musicologist, Steve Metcalf, the Ed Sullivan of the Garmany Chamber Music Series at Hart School. Tomorrow night, Sybarite 5. The Beatles of Modern Chamber Music. Get your ticket if you didn't already.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Hey, Beatles, do you take requests? Because if you do, can you play Imagine? Oh, even these Beatles think that song is overplayed.